present any proper talk. No. It would just be an introduction that is supposed to kickstart the discussion, and then we can jump on each other. So, welcome upstream.
Okay, so in the spirit of convergence and bringing together new ideas and you know discussing areas where we don't actually have any results, but just you know sort of future thinking. So in that spirit, Flavia asked me to talk about or lead a discussion on the question: what can shape dynamics do for asymptotic safety, and vice versa, what can asymptotic safety do for shape dynamics? So if you're tired after a long day, let me just give you the bottom line right now. Yes, the answer is nothing. No. So what I would like to do here is to sort of, you know, present my personal view on what the answer to these things could be and then open this up for discussion. So what could asymptotic safety do for shape dynamics? Well, asymptotic safety is sort of a framework which allows you to quantize a theory or to provide the UV completion to understand the effect of quantum fluctuations. And so what asymptotic safety could do for shape dynamics is to provide a framework in which you understand the quantum version of shape dynamics. And so in order to set this up, I will review some basics of asymptotic safety and sort of review the key idea so that we are all on the same page to discuss this. And then answering, well, what can shape dynamics do for asymptotic safety? Well, so within the asymptotic safety framework, we usually just sort of quantize standard gravity based on a space-time picture. And there is a lot of evidence that this actually works and that this gives you some sort of quantum theory. And so, well, what could shape dynamics do for that program? So my answer would be that shape dynamics could give you a sort of inequivalent quantum theory of gravity within that framework, and sort of more specifically, and I would explain what I mean by that, it could provide a different universality class for gravity. And if you right now don't really understand what I mean by that word, I will get to explaining what I mean. So to summarize the answer, well, asymptotic safety could provide a framework to quantize shape dynamics, and shape dynamics could provide us with new universality classes for quantum gravity. Okay, so to set the stage for asymptotic safety, what asymptotic safety does is it helps you to deal with sort of the main challenge in quantum gravity. So what's the main challenge in any quantum field theory? It's, you know, given a path integral, where you're supposed to sum over all possible field configurations, including different, in the case of gravity, different configurations of space-time or different configurations of space, whatever your preferred view is. The question is, how do you do this integral, which really contains quantum fluctuations on all possible scales? And asymptotic safety is a way to control quantum fluctuations on all scales and really give meaning to this sort of path integral. And by the way, if you have any questions or points that you would like to make, just feel free to interrupt me. Okay.
What does the subscript after the integral sign mean? High, is that a minus or a what?
What, this one? Where? Oh, yeah, so I'll get to that. Right now I'm in.
Oh, sorry, you're running again.
Going to get to
that. So I guess obvious question, right? If your shape dynamics is just the word scales.
Yeah, I think we can let's sort of save this for the discussion. But I think I have some things which we could maybe discuss. So let's for now just keep this as a sort of very general quantum field theory framework where this is kind of more obvious what to do with it. Okay, so generically, if you're given such a path integral, then a good idea to address it is introduce a notion of scale and then do the path integral sort of momentum shell-wise. So first take care of these completely wild quantum fluctuations which have lots of structure on small scales, sort of do the path integral over those high momentum modes, and then what this gives you is an effective action for the low momentum modes. So this naturally leads to the notion of renormalization group flow. So what the renormalization group flow allows you to understand is if you decompose this path integral in sort of momentum shells, how does the effective action for the low momentum modes change as you integrate out the high momentum modes? And so this effective action will then depend on some renormalization group scale that tells you, well, all the modes which have momenta above k, they've been integrated out, and the lower ones haven't been integrated out. So this naturally then leads us to the notion of running scale-dependent couplings, because what the high momentum modes do is they generically change this effective action. We can parameterize this just by letting the couplings and the action depend on the scale. Okay, and then generically for any such quantum field theory, there are really two categories into which it could fall. So one of them is an effective theory, which means that there will be a cutoff scale, a finite cutoff scale, at which the running couplings hit a divergent, and this is what we call the scale of new physics, which means that this is a good low energy description for the system you're looking at, but it doesn't really tell you what the microscopic dynamics is. And well, a lot of quantum field theories fall into this category. For instance, quantum electrodynamics or the Standard Model itself is a low energy effective theory. So it comes with some scale of new physics. Now, in general, if you're thinking about quantum gravity, what you would really like to get is some sort of really fundamental understanding. So going beyond an effective theory setting, and then what you have to require is that the running couplings under the renormalization group flow reach a finite ultraviolet limit so that you can really take your cutoff to infinity and really do this complete path integral over all field configurations so that the theory makes sense. And for that, you have to have this finite ultraviolet limit of the couplings. Okay, more questions? Yes, yeah.
Standard model ignoring gravity on a Minkowski background. What is it that is diverging? The Higgs, the Landau pole of the Higgs.
So we have two Landau poles. If you just look at the U1 and the abelian gauge theory, that has a Landau pole, and lambda phi to the 4 theory has a Landau pole. And so these are important sectors of the standard model. And so you would assume that these Landau poles carry over to the case of the standard model.
The U1 sector alone.
That's actually even enough. Yeah. So to deal with the U1 Landau pole problem, you could go to a grand unified setting, but that's obviously new physics. It's beyond the standard model. So the general setting for such a finite ultraviolet limit is a fixed point in the space of all possible couplings, which is generically an infinite dimensional space. Let me just very briefly,
Can I just ask a question about the field theory? Sure. So in the field theory, there's one other thing when you notice that the couplings are diverging, then you sort of stop and you say the theory is no longer valid. At what point in effective theory do you want to stop and start flowing and say, okay, now I'm reaching a bad description?
Well, I mean, it depends on the framework that you're using, but I mean, typically this is also done within perturbation theory. And so you would stop when your coupling becomes large. And I think typically what happens with the Landau poles is that there are not really many scales between the scale where the coupling becomes large and where it just really diverges. Okay, good. So this second possibility here has to do with this fixed point in the space of couplings. And why do I actually care about the space of all possible couplings? It's because in this process of integrating out quantum fluctuations, all operators are generated for you. So therefore, you can't just fix the form of an action that you like and just keep that action. Quantum fluctuations will generate all other operators for you. So by all other operators, I mean all of those compatible with the symmetries. So if you're given a specific theory, such as shape dynamics, the first thing to do is actually to figure out what this theory space is. So what are actually all possible couplings that are compatible with the symmetries? And then sort of a fundamental quantum field theory is one where you have such a fixed point which you reach in the ultraviolet. And really one of the crucial things about such a scenario is the question of predictivity. Right? So working in an infinite dimensional space of couplings, you could sort of wonder whether this scenario is going to be predictive at all or whether you're going to have an infinite number of free parameters. But generically what happens is that you have a sort of a so-called UV critical surface, and this is the one that I drew in purple here, and only from within this surface you will actually be attracted into this fixed point as you go towards the UV. On the other hand, this means that all of these red points down here are viable starting points for your couplings at low energies, because from all of them you will flow into the fixed point. And so the dimensionality of this critical hypersurface, this is the number of free parameters that your theory will have. And generically, all other directions will actually be repelled by the fixed point, which means that if you want to hit the fixed point, you actually have to fix the value, in this case, of this coupling G3. It's fixed precisely to lie within this critical surface, otherwise your theory is not UV complete. And so this sort of wraps up asymptotic safety in a nutshell, and let me just make this point again, that this is a framework that could provide what I would like to call quantum shape dynamics. Yes?
Just quickly, there's no rule to make sure you do it the right surface, you just have to strike lucky, is that it, or what?
No, well, I mean, and so I suppose in nature you do have to be lucky in some sense. So on the other hand, you can turn it around and say, well, let's assume that this is the ultraviolet completion of my theory, then this gives me predictions for the values of all the irrelevant couplings. And then, of course, you can compare these two experiments and see whether you actually lie within that critical surface or not. Okay, and picking up on a point that came up during one of the discussions earlier in the morning, so that has to do with this question of, well, what is the correct action that you should pick in shape dynamics or just in sort of any kind of quantum field theory? Well, the point is that within this way of thinking here, you don't really ever have to pick a dynamics. You just specify what your symmetries are and the degrees of freedom, and this uniquely specifies theory space, and then you just calculate the renormalization group flow and you find what possible UV and infrared fixed points there are. And so then if you want a theory that makes sense on all scales, then clearly you have to pick a trajectory that ends in a UV fixed point and an infrared fixed point, and that automatically predicts the dynamics on all scales for you. So there is no ambiguity where you say, well, on Monday I prefer to add this term to my dynamics and on Tuesday I prefer another term. The theory just predicts the dynamics that it would like to have.
But yeah. Of course, that's easier said than done, right? Because calculating these RG flows and
I don't know. Well, I mean, at this conference is about thinking about the future and throwing wild ideas at each other, right? So that's what I'm doing here. Yeah. Yeah, you need the surface to be finite dimensional, otherwise your framework will not be predicted. So there are general arguments which you can use to argue that it will generally be, but let me not get into those details here maybe. Okay, so the other point I would like to make, for that I would like to use an analogy of another interacting fixed point that we actually know much better than in the case of gravity, and this is in a three-dimensional system of just a scalar field theory, so just a scalar which transforms under an ON symmetry. And this features a very famous interacting fixed point, which you can see here in the space of couplings. It's the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. And this plays a huge role, actually, in statistical physics and condensed matter. And the point that I would like to draw your attention to is that is these numbers here, the theta 1 and theta 2. These are the critical exponents, and these are the guys that actually tell you whether you have an attractive or a repulsive direction of the fixed point. So these are the guys that you want to calculate to understand sort of what are your repulsive and what are your UV attractive directions. And so these numbers really, in some sense, define your quantum theory. And the thing to note here is that they change as a function of n. So if you put in a different symmetry, then you will get different values for the critical exponents. And in particular, it can also happen that for different symmetry groups, you will get a different number of positive critical exponents. So the positive, these are the ones that are actually related to free parameters. And so the point that I would like to make here is that what we call a universality class, which is just characterized by the values of these critical exponents, this depends on the degrees of freedom and the symmetry. And so what this tells you is that if you have different theories for gravity, which differ in the degrees of freedom or which differ in the symmetry that you put in, then generically you should expect to have sort of different universality classes, different fixed points, different numbers for the critical exponents, possibly even a different number of the free parameters. And sort of this is what I think shape dynamics could contribute to the asymptotic safety program. It could provide us with another universality class for gravity. Okay, and now really kind of jumping ahead by probably one or two decades. let's assume that we would know that we have such fixed points in gravity, which provide us different versions of quantum gravity, and that we have these different universality classes, for instance, one of them just based on sort of standard gravity based on a space-time picture, and the other one based on shape dynamics. What do we do with them? Then, of course, the task that we have at hand is to really decide observationally, well, which is the one that nature actually chose to realize, right? And so here I would just like to throw 2 points at you for discussion. How do we distinguish different universality classes? Well, for such a fixed point, as I said previously, the irrelevant couplings, those are fixed precisely, their values are actually predictions. And so this is something that if you have different universality classes, you would end up with different predictions for, let's say, something like a higher curvature coupling. And of course, in principle, this would be something that you could observe. And then the other point I would like to make is that within the sort of standard asymptotic safety scenario, we do have a number of low energy tests that can actually be used to, in principle, rule out such a model. And this very much has to do with the fact that in our universe, it's not just gravity, there's also matter. And now we have to make sure that if we add matter to this picture, that this microscopic dynamics based on the fixed point isn't destroyed. And to just very briefly sort of flash the idea at you, so what I'm showing you here is the fact that matter degrees of freedom, so scalars, Dirac fermions, and so on, can in principle destroy the fixed point in pure gravity. And so we have bounds on the allowed number of degrees of freedom that are compatible with asymptotic safety. And one thing that I would like to point out in the context here is that we already know that if we look at different versions of gravity, then we will get different bounds. So what I'm showing you here in purple is sort of standard standard gravity. And the blue version here is unimodular gravity, where you change the degrees of freedom and the symmetries. And you see that you have different matter bounds. So all of this is, of course, in sort of approximate calculations. But you could, in principle, envisage a scenario where you have asymptotic safety in different quantum gravity models, but you have different bounds on the matter degrees of freedom. And then you just ask the people from the LHC, well, how many scalars have you detected? And they tell you, well, we have the standard model plus so and so many scalars. And you end up somewhere here where some of your quantum gravity theories pass the test and others don't. And so this is something that I would just like to throw out for the discussion for shape dynamics. Well, do you know whether shape dynamics is compatible with the existence of the standard model? Just with the standard model degrees of freedom.
The bound on particle types or
yes, it's really just, you know, not very deep. It's just, you know, the scalar has a particular effect on the quantum gravity fixed point. It can actually kill the fixed point, and so there's a bound on the number of scalars. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, within this framework, something similar should mm-hmm. be valid for shape dynamics. And then another powerful test in principle for quantum gravity is the fact that the standard model has a particular type of fermions, namely chiral or light fermions. And in general, this is not something that is trivial to accommodate in a quantum gravity theory. So this is, in principle, another observational test. Okay, so with that, I would just like to throw out a few questions that I think we could maybe discuss here. So the first would be, well, could shape dynamics actually become asymptotically safe, which would provide you with a quantum shape dynamics theory? And how can we actually find that out? And then assuming that you would complete that program, the question is, well, is it compatible with observed matter, all its properties, and everything that we sort of know about low energy universe? Also, one of the other questions is asymptotically safe shape dynamics maybe in some sense better than the usual version of asymptotic safety? For instance, does it feature a higher degree of predictivity, which would, in principle, make it, of course, very attractive? And then one of the other questions that probably Lee is going to be interested in is there's this question whether the asymptotic safety is unitary, so whether it whether the propagator really just propagates physical particles. In principle, if you change the theory space, this could also change. And so just to end up with the technical challenge, so you would have to adapt renormalization group tools to the case of the shape dynamics theory space to sort of find out about these questions. And I hope this provides enough material to now keep discussing for a while.
Yeah. I guess we're not talking, but I feel like we should talk. There's maybe another question, because it may be that the scenario is not asymptotic safety, but that there's a Gaussian fixed point in the theory space.
I would say asymptotic freedom is a special case of asymptotic safety, right? But yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Also, this is great. I talked to Hatope. You said this is like skipping ahead 10 years, right? But Hatope seems to be 10 years ahead of everybody. And he said that he did in point two with biogravity in the space-time picture.
Mm-hmm.
calculated all the beta functions, forced them all to vanish, and he mm-hmm. said, I know he was working on that, remember, when he came to the conference, so I asked him what happened, and he said, I made all the beta functions vanish, but if the standard models ruled out, so I didn't publish it.
Cool, so I should definitely add it to my plot.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Oh, okay, so it makes sense to redo his calculation because it excludes a particular model of quantum gravity from observations, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
It's a null.
It depends on the type of bounds, right? If you have strict bounds on all kinds of matter.
So I should encourage him to publish it, even though it's not. So.
So when you calculate beta functions, usually the starting point is a covariant formulation mm-hmm. of the theory on a fixed background.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So are there any exceptions to that?
So in the case of gravity, you know, the question of background independence and the renormalization group flow becomes really important. So then it just becomes technically complicated. So what you do is you use the background field method. So you split your metric into a background piece and a fluctuation piece, and then you leave the background piece completely arbitrary, which technically implies that you will have running couplings that belong to background operators and running couplings that belong to the fluctuation operators. And you will have modified water identities that encode the background independence. So technically, it becomes much more challenging, but there is no, in principle, problem with applying renormalization group techniques to settings where you don't have any background. And so, you know, applying it to gravity is really just a technical challenge.
And also, the other thing is that shape dynamics has a sort of Hamiltonian formulation. So to approach a calculation for beta function, you need to somehow covariantize it.
Yeah, I think you would have. I mean, I would assume that you would have to come up with just with the Lagrangian formulation to apply these techniques.
Really? So can't you do the
but presumably,
picture?
I mean, I'm just not an expert on how you do that in the Hamiltonian formulation.
So I know.
What's the technical challenge?
Well, presumably you can set it up in the same way. Yeah.
There's no techniques developed. So, I mean, I know some of the office mates who are experts, and they try to do the RG4 and Hajava Lipschitz, right? Mm-hmm. And they just... No, but what they do is they formulate it in a... They undo the Legendre transform from the Hamiltonian, and then write a kind of covariant action. And then they start with that, and they use it, their tools. So it's really, we spent like a month trying to translate between their intuition and my intuition, which comes from canonical flows. So you have to like picture the phase space path integral, then integrate over P. And then that's where they seem to know how to use techniques to deal with this. So that was already a challenge.
So,
because, like, for example, like counting degrees of freedom. So the way we count degrees of freedom is by looking at the number of constraints and the dimension of phase space, and then kind of you have a constraint and then there's a gauge fixing. But the way they count degrees of freedom is with gauge symmetries and on shell conditions, right? So for each gauge fixing, you get an on shell condition, and then that, because there's no gauge fixing when you undone the Legendre transform, there aren't even constraints. So you just the whole language is different. And
me, Flavio, and Tim, we were trying to work at least to work out something like the one loop determinant for
canonical flow.
And the thing that we were doing that in, we can switch up what is the gauge fixing and what is the actual Lagrangian. And we are using basically the ADM as a mixture of a gauge fixing, an ADM delta function as a mixture of a gauge fixing and the Hamiltonian, but still in the PQ dot minus this term. And we were using some of these tools that we were calculating, basically functional determinants and things like that. And there are some tools that you can use there which you couldn't use if you consider the opposite as CMC to be a gauge, or CMC to be a gauge fixing and not a gauge transformation. There, it's not completely symmetric. What you can do with a gauge fixing inside the delta function is not completely symmetric with what you can.
Well, first of all, your physical states are different, right?
That's right. Your boundary states would be
the conformal constraint and the other
so,
one.
But we.
The boundary states.
But we stopped.
Yeah. I got that.
I know.
Some problems are like a good wine, they get better.
You leave them for a while.
They just solve themselves.
But this is a sociological problem, right? Because maybe it's a practical problem. So you have to, these calculations are so long. Like, the way Frank, like, he budgets time for these projects. Like, I don't know, you need 6 months of, because then you have to work out. And then they really, like, stick to a schedule. So, I mean, for us, that would just be impractical because how many of us are going to be in the same place for more than 3 weeks?
Oh, you don't have to be in the same place to do that.
Okay. Maybe you know how to do this better than we do, because you actually do these things. I don't think.
My impression is that you can define perturbation theory in a Hamiltonian manner. It may be messier, but on the other hand, you don't have all the covariance, so you're not going to have the benefits of using covariant perturbation theory. But the question that I would be interested in to get started is that I don't know any way to discuss a quantum field theory without putting on a cutoff. And that breaks scale invariance. And that's in tension with the, I know Julian
was saying. When you finish, please.
I'm not raising this as an objection of principle, but it seems to me that there's something, there should be a, to really do the quantum mechanics of shape dynamics properly would require a new way of thinking about the quantization or quantum mechanics. It doesn't require cutting the infinite number of degrees of freedom down to the finite number of degrees of freedom with the scale and then considering functions, correlation functions as they depend on that scale and taking the limits in which it goes away and so forth.
But in our universe, we don't just have gravity, right? We do have matter as well. And in the standard model, scale invariance is broken. The low energy limit of QCD looks completely different from the high energy limit. So
yes, but my I appreciate that. But my impression is that if we take shape dynamics seriously, the scale invariance is a strong property. It's not a property that you want to be. I mean, in particle physics, we're happy to start with a theory which is scale invariant, which is standard model, and then break it with a regularization.
Well, it's not scale invariant as soon as you add the Higgs mass, right? Just without the Higgs.
Yes, yes, without the Higgs.
I don't think there is a real problem there, because you just need to use physical fields as giving you the scale.
Yeah.
It's still a point, a particular point in your conformal superspace plus matter, a state in which you have some conformal geometry, and a vector field that has these values here
in
a patch.
So tell me what any quantum field theory that I understand is defined by truncating it to a theory of a finite number of degrees of freedom, and then defining the quantum field theory as a limit in which that number of degrees of freedom goes to infinity. So for example, lattice gauge theory approximates quantum Young-Mills theory. QED with a fixed cutoff approximates QED and so forth. What is the theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom that approximates shape dynamics?
No, I'm just saying that your calculation, to regularize your calculations, you just have to sandwich your integral between external states that are some states of a field, and that field will have some, will be your probe, and will have some spatial resolution.
But it's not just the states, you have to truncate the measure of that.
Yes, but the thing is, the idea is that the full calculation is well approximated by a regularized one, and case by case, according to the state of the probe field, you might have what normally is considered just a cutoff in your so theory. I'm just saying that you need to do it relationally, in some sense, or carefully.
Yeah, but
it's
I mean,
a conjecture, I'm not saying
that. Apart from that, I think, you know, just the observation of broken scale invariance in the meta sector should force you guys to think about what it really implies for shape dynamics. Because it, I mean, in the real world, scale invariance is broken.
For the scale invariance is broken.
Mm-hmm. So
while invariance in four dimensions
mm-hmm.
is broken.
Yes. So what does this mean if for shape dynamics coupled to matter, if you want to apply this not just as a theory of gravity, but as a theory of gravity for our universe?
But then, it's still true that we have dimensional quantity, even if we write, mm-hmm. so she's right, I mean, we have a notion of vial invariance, but we also have a dimensional quantity that we have to put in, and we don't know how to get rid of it, just the Higgs mass.
And the cosmological constant.
Well, so then you have broken scale invariance. So then in the RG flow, you will generate all operators that break scale invariance if you break it by hand.
So we have a description of the dynamics in terms of vial invariant quantities. We still have to introduce these two dimensional quantities into the formulas. And that's, you know, the way of expressing the fact that there's broken scale invariance and shape dynamics. And that's, at the moment, I don't know how to get rid of that. But to address something that, like when I talk to Giulio, okay, maybe we should, in Frank, about this issue of the background, because you have background field methods, right? So they kind of say, they're not so worried about having an RG flow and a vial invariant theory because they say, well, we can use a background metric to define a scale, but then as long as, you know, you trust that the background field method is making it so that observables are independent of your choice of background, then you don't have to worry that you're just using the background as a tool.
So don't take the scale physically seriously. Just take it
seriously
as a tool.
But then you know. So. But if you use background method carefully, then none of the observable quantities should depend on that choice. And I don't know if I believe that, but that at least we're not that worried about it.
Well, let's go on a bit, please. I have one or two questions really, comments.
If you have a theory with broken scale invariance, you can talk about that in terms of renormalization loop trajectory, which asymptotes to a fixed point, which is the picture you're thinking of. But if you're thinking that scale invariance is of gauge invariance, so there's a difference between breaking global symmetries and breaking local symmetries in path integrals. It's very difficult to break gauge symmetries in path integrals and restore them. You have to pay very careful attention to the measure and so forth. And that's why we do today's top off, etc. No, but to my knowledge, nobody has succeeded in taking a theory and defining it in terms of renormalization of the trajectory purely on the fixed point mm-hmm. rather than asymptotically to the fixed point.
Yeah.
But if you really take steps, I'm trying to take shape dynamics seriously. If you really take shape dynamics seriously, you believe that all of the apparent physical scales are actually ratios of physical dynamical variables. And I find that view attractive, but to me it suggests that you're really trying to find a theory on a fixed point.
Yeah.
If the metaphor works at all. And that's very, very tricky. I'm not saying you can't do it, but it's not just another kind of calculation.
I mean, I think it's
not just a technical challenge, but I think it's a conceptual challenge.
I think we have to separate global scale from local
scale. Local
scale,
because
breaking local scale invariance is what really would.
It might be that,
universality class. If you want to.
Yeah, I'm confused about two things. One is the thing that you said. I mean, breaks space-time local scale or spatial? Because, I mean, in spatial scale, does anything break it? If you change the frame in relativity, at least, what is the scale that, right? I mean, you have no, the scale is not fixed. But this is not what I was going to say. I was going to say that so if you look at the intersection picture here, and this is something that I was going to discuss tomorrow, but it's brought up now.
You're bringing it up.
No, but it's brought up in relation to this, in relation to if there is a preferred scale or if there's some scale that we can think of that approximately will be the one that GR gives us. So
what we call, in some cases, the ADM gauge. And even if you don't think about it, there's a class of theory that generalizes, well, I should write it like this, that generalizes state dynamics in the following sense, that you still have a theory at an intersection surface. But there is no theory that represents it that has refoliation invariance. There are only classes of theories that have scaling invariance, but you define them here locally, basically. And then you have some free parameters for this theory. And they're basically, so you have, let's say, A of R, and there's some uniqueness to it. So you have something like the kinetic term would be like this. Then here you have some B, pi squared. I mean, imagine that I'm. And then you have some functional of the volume here. Actually, you can absorb this into the cosmological constant by some version of it in the cosmological constant. This would be a Hamiltonian that you would get, and it has these three parameters, and so far as I understand it, these are the most general ones that only close on basically this on surfaces that have constant trace of pi. So these are the only ones that from what I understand, that close everywhere on phase. So what do I want to say? That this form is the most general one. That if you take the Poisson bracket with itself, it will close whenever this condition is met, basically. And
what is general?
Sorry.
What is V?
It's the volume. It's the total volume. So here you see, usually for GR you'd have a half here, but here you can have the general one. It doesn't close in GR, but if the trace of pi is equal to a constant, then it will close. And so it means that you can use the usual LOI stuff to make this into a fully conformal theory here, but there's no compatible theory that has the foliation invariance. So the idea that some people here, I think Roger was saying, is that maybe you could have some kind of flow of these things to a GR setting, in which you do obtain refoliation.
You have a tiny theory space there. B A is not really physical because you can reabsorb it into a definition. But in the end, B and F, F is no local, so maybe one could say it's suppressed.
In the IR, it might be. I mean, that's the IR,
This is where we have to be really careful, because in our intuition because we're coming from a Kant point of view, our intuition is that there has to be like constraints and they need to be propagated and all of that. But then we're mixing that with our intuition from effective field theory, where there are no constraints at all. And then the terms are generated, and there's no constraints when you have integrate over the J-space.
There are quantum constraints.
If you're dealing with a configuration space path integral, you're in configuration space. You're in configuration space, so you don't have the constraints anymore.
But because you integrated the momenta, but you can't work out phase space.
But you shouldn't think of like the constraints. The Kalman theory as being like related to the kind of effective field theory on sets that you have, where you have all kinds of terms and they're being generated, and then these consistency conditions are constraints on those on that flow, right? That's just not, we're mixing two intuitions when we're thinking that way.
You're saying that the closure doesn't have anything to do with a flow, with the renormalization group flow.
Yes, exactly. So we have this intuition that the quantum fluctuations are going to generate all kinds of terms, but it's not terms like this. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but okay, but I don't know. I mean, this is just, again, I don't really understand this.
Yeah.
But
your other point that there's an interesting other theories which, but I don't know. Again, like
no, but.
I don't know what it means for a theory like this.
So wouldn't closure be associated to unitarity of the theory? If this is the Hamiltonian and it's generating...
Again, like, closure is on... The whole point is that when you're in phase space, there's not the Legendre transform. The problem with the constraints is that making the Legendre transform will apply. But if you're on configuration space, there is no Legendre transform, right? You're working with... You don't have to worry about. But I don't know what consistency at the canonical level has to do with configuration space picture. But
the algebra of the constraints at the canonical level is input into what the measure of the path integral of
right.
configuration space is.
Right. So it comes into the ghosts.
And so often the measure is not trivial on the configuration
right.
space and would not have been guessed naively. If you don't come from the canonical theory
right.
and carefully evaluate
right.
the Poisson brackets.
That's right. Where it comes in is the ghosts.
Brackets
yeah. You see all of the stuff in the ghosts. Because,
and not even. I mean, there can be terms. There can be terms mm-hmm. in the measure of the Gauge theory,
well,
which...
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if you're lucky, then you can get everything into... You can exponentiate some determinant and express in terms
mm-hmm.
of Gauss.
Yeah, yeah.
To the cases where you're not looking, you have to just treat the measure directly.
Yeah. So I can come in at this point. It seems to me there might just be something in front of us. But I first just preface this by saying I'm terribly confused in all of this stuff. However, Lee, just to take up on these things, it seems to be a major issue is to do with very large momentum. Correct? When you said you do anything with a quantum field theory, you first of all truncated to a finite number of degrees of freedom which you're going to go to infinity. But do you, on top of that, for each of the degrees of freedom that you retain, impose a cutoff on the, you integrate out these high momentum states bit by bit? Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Almost. It's the same thing. If you go to a Fourier basis,
yeah.
the degrees of freedom are not labeled by points, they're labeled by momenta. The Pavian degrees of freedom are labeled by momenta. And saying that there's enough of a cutoff to the momentum restricts the degree of freedom to a finite. If the system is in a finite volume, then saying there's an ultimate momentum or highest momentum restricts yourself to a finite number of degrees of freedom of momentum. So it's the same thing.
Yeah. All I want to say is the thing that has come to me recently is it seems to me, at least for in terms of the initial data of this by magic Janus point, which I've never done, it's only the ratios of the momenta that count. There is no meaning to the magnitudes of the momenta. Magnitudes of momenta do not determine the solution. This is all at the classical level. And I just wonder whether that isn't actually of.
So this is why I asked about the volume of space. If the volume of space is meaningful, if I'm allowed to make ratios between the volume of space and wavelengths, then you could express everything that way. That is, what's relevant is that there's a finite volume of space, and there's a shortest wavelength, which can be defined in ratio to the volume of space.
Well, actually, the thing that is, I think, really significant is not so much that one. I mean, we get a finite measure for shape space, because shape space, you actually just remove the volume factor and it just ceases to be counted. So you in the three-body problem, you just have the shape sphere. So each point on the shape sphere corresponds to the shape of the triangle, and you just set that surface equal to one, whatever you like. That's fixed. And the place no really cannot expand, so that's fixed. Then the second thing which comes in, which is really striking, is due to dynamical similarity. This is the thing that in the Newtonian two-body problem means that if you don't have a clock and you don't have a rod, all the planetary the orbits with the same eccentricity are identical. It just matches them all down. And that means there's no significance to initial momentum. There's no way that you could say this has got a certain angular momentum or things like that. It's all just one ellipse with the same eccentricity and, if you like, the same direction of the axis, the major axis. And this conceivably changes things in a dramatic way. It certainly does, I think, in terms of the initial value problem.
Yeah, but it doesn't solve Lee's problem.
It doesn't, which is Lee's problem.
You're just talking about having taking ratios of momenta or projectifying momenta that you want. And he's talking about the number of momenta.
But I thought he said
an infinite amount of them, even if your basis manifold is compact. And even if you take a ratio, only ratios of momenta or unit momenta, they're still infinite.
Yes, no, but I understand you said that you increase it, but if you, did I misunderstand it? That you would then get something that makes sense if you can.
What you increase is the number of modes.
Hmm?
What you increase is the number
of
modes.
Oh, yes, no, that's fair enough.
You take a finite amount of them and then you'll.
But didn't he then say that under certain circumstances it works out okay when you increase the number of modes?
No,
I misunderstood it.
I was conjecturing a way to approach the problem. I have no idea whether it's sufficient to address that.
Here's another way. I mean, I don't know if I agree that having a cutoff is, I mean, it's necessary formally, but I mean, if the scenario is that you have a second order phase transition in UV phase completion, is defining your UV completion, then, you know, formally your correlation functions are divergent, and then the divergent in the cutoff scale. So the point is that second order phase transition allows you to just send the cutoff to zero, formally, and then you, that's, I thought that, maybe you should.
But is a test mechanical system where there is the second order phase transition, is a system with a finite number of degrees of freedom. You can't do, if you want to work, in the limit, in the thermodynamic limit, where there's infinite number of degrees of freedom, thermodynamic functions become singular. And it becomes very difficult to compute them directly in that limit. Therefore, people truncate theory to a large but finite number of degrees of freedom, whereas quantities like the specific heat are still smooth, calculate them, find this fixed point structure, the phase diagram, find the critical trajectories, etc., define the theory on a trajectory into a fixed point. And then and only then
yes.
take the limit.
Yeah, exactly.
Because another way to say that is that the different phases in the limit
that you take
n to infinity, the different phases of material live in different Hilbert spaces.
So you're saying, how do you keep that Fallon variance at all levels in the RG flow? Because okay, here, if you're studying Wilson-Fisher or something, you find the fixed point, then you take the limit. You have to discretize at all stages.
Right.
So
the naive thing to do would be to break scale invariance, impose a cutoff.
Yeah, impose a cutoff.
But that feels wrong because
you're
giving up the fundamental defining property of the whole idea.
Right. No,
so if there's another way to truncate and define a theory as a limit of a truncated theory with each with a finite number of degrees of freedom, and keep the ontology with the theory of shapes of things in that scale. I don't know how to do that, but it seems to me if the world could be a good way to do that, that would be going forward.
So you're asking essentially for a renormalization group flow that's set up in a more abstract space that has nothing to do with momenta, but just solves field configurations according to some abstract principle that has nothing to do with scale. And then you would want to understand the renormalization.
Or has something
space.
To do with, I mean, I like what Julian talks about ratio. If you are always, because there's always an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, if you could say the infinite number of degrees of freedom is the limit if the ratio goes to infinity, it doesn't matter whether you take the bias to infinity or the cutoff to zero.
Yeah, it could be like this scale they introduced, this RG scale is just a bookkeeping device, which is keeping track of some, operationally is keeping track of some ratio. I think that's the way people think of.
Well, or you just introduce a renormalization group scale that is a field. Just use a scalar field, and then you know, just the value of that sets a scale, but it, you know, doesn't break scale invariance. But you can still use then you just set up a renormalization group according to that.
It's just in strong interactions, and I know you see it, but you have the young meals. Yeah.
It's
a finite resolution is what cures those, and they are divergences, but they are cured by the way the probes. The way you.
What is that? You could use this, but you still need a UV cutoff. Even if you do set up a scale by some scale.
Well, it sort of. It depends on from the point of view of the functional renormalization group. You can either think in terms of the path integral, and then you need to include a UV cutoff to make it well-defined, or you think in terms of the functional renormalization group equation, which is the equation for the flowing action. It only has an infrared cutoff. It doesn't have an extra UV cutoff. It's automatically UV and infrared finite because it only depends on sort of momentum, on momentum around a certain momentum shell. And so you could just say, forget about the path integral. We are just taking the flow equation as the definition of our quantum field theory, and it will automatically give us the limit where we will generate all correlation function, everything that can be observed. So that in that picture, you never need to think about it.
There you're literally integrating those out.
Yes.
The higher momentum.
The effective action at a scale k only gets contributions from momenta in a momentum shell around k. So it's only sort of k plus minus delta k modes that contribute at all.
Okay.
So you never specifically, you never cut off UV or infrared separately. It's automatically, the structure of the equation is such that it only just, responds to quantum fluctuations in that momentum shell. And so it's, in that sense, the change of the action at k is completely insensitive to whatever happens at, some UV cutoff lambda. It's just sensitive to what happens around k. And so if you just take that seriously as the definition of your quantum field theory, then you don't need to introduce an UV cutoff.
So we just need some dust to set the scale.
Different question.
Yeah.
Do you have an expansion of shape dynamics about flat space yet? Because one of the questions Astrid you posed was a propagator.
Well, but I mean, you would want the propagator around the true vacuum. Right, so the true vacuum, in our universe, presumably is the sitter. It does, so what, the behavior around flat space in some sense is completely irrelevant. You could have, ghosts around flat space as much as you want. It would just tell you that flat space is unstable, which is fine because in our universe, we actually have a cosmological constant. So I think you would care about the propagator around that background.
True.
Yeah.
Can I ask another thing? Mm-hmm. This is your concern about the Higgs theory. I spoke briefly 4 weeks ago to John Ellis from CERN. He was at a bizarre kind of thing that I go to. And I asked him about how is one to think about the Higgs field before this phase transition where apparently things happen and the Higgs field kicks in and gives masses to people. That's my understanding of the thing. And I said, does everything then become, I know very little about this. I said, does everything then become massless and everything go at the speed of light? He said, no, because it's like photons in a refractive medium.
Most of your mass doesn't come from the Higgs mass, from the Higgs mechanism. It comes from chiral symmetry breaking in QCD. So there's another place where the standard model breaks scale invariance, which is the effect of quantum fluctuations gives you a non-trivial beta function in QCD, which leads to a strongly coupled infrared limit, which breaks chiral symmetry, and which gives mass to quarks. And actually, most of the mass of the proton and neutron is that effect. So if you remove the Higgs mass, the electron becomes massless, so atoms aren't unstable anymore, but protons and neutrons essentially keep their mass. So even if you don't think about the Higgs at all, you still have this effect of scale, non-scale invariant.
Do protons and neutrons exist very early in the universe? Isn't it? Don't you have to come down to a certain temperature before you get to that?
So you also have a temperature for the QCD phase transition before you break chiral symmetry. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So if you go right back even further, and then I asked John Ellis, what about the idea that the universe becomes exactly scale invariant at the Big Bang? And he said, well, there are quite a lot of people who think that, who do take that. So I just wonder whether that's a relevant issue and whether that might not be a factor.
Well, but you still have the point that quantum fluctuations will break scale invariance and will give you a non-trivial infrared behavior that is distinct from the UV behavior.
So, so this is Coleman-Weinberg that, that don't flow correctly in the IR, right?
What do you mean?
Coleman-Weinberg
yes.
Having the scaling the conformal invariant coupling for the Higgs in the UV and then flowing towards the IR and getting all the mass from that from relative direction.
That, that, that doesn't work out quantitatively.
Like a lot by magnitude.
Not sure, right, but that doesn't like work out quantitatively. Yeah.
But that was ignoring completely the QCD sector, right? And you're saying that, yeah, even without Higgs, the QCD sector on its own will get.
Yeah, I mean, so in QCD you have the phase transition, right, from the quark gluon plasma to the phase of bound states of protons, neutrons, and mesons, and and they are massive because chiral symmetry is broken in the infrared in QCD.
Right.
And you know, the, that gives you a mass of essentially one GeV for the proton and neutron, whereas the, you know, Higgs-generated masses for the quarks are a few EV, MeV, so it's just very, very much below that.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, in some sense, there are two places where scale invariance is broken.
Right, but that is below, so, right? So if it's ultra high energy, you can...
At very high temperature, yeah.
Very, very high temperature, right.
Yeah.
Can you still have an... while invariant UV fixed point?
Yes, I think, but I mean, you still need to accommodate the fact that you will break scale invariants.
Yeah, I think we need to try to understand how these effects happen. Like, for the general relational program, if we, you know, we need to understand how these things happen in a relational way where there's no absolute scale. So, I mean, it's clear that these are physical effects, right? But maybe the challenge to the program is to try to interpret them in terms of, like, ratios of things that are happening, and then what we interpret as scale. Just sort of like the way we interpret the expansion of the universe in the toy model as some dissipative flow on shape space, right? Maybe there's a way to interpret these masses in that way. Because ultimately, yeah, sorry, I mean, where they come up in shape dynamics is in, so in this case it would be the mass of the quarks in the standard model plus the Higgs, I didn't appreciate that, plus the Higgs mass and the cosmological constant. Those are all dimensionful quantities.
But I mean, so in the standard model, in the microscopic version, you don't write any masses for the quarks. They are forbidden by chiral symmetry. So it's just a non-perturbative effect in QCD that generates masses for the effective flow energy. So you can't just, you know, you don't put a mass term for the quarks. It works in a sort of dynamical way. It's more complicated, but the statement remains that it breaks scale invariance.
Our IR theory has a bunch of parameters and that have dimensions, mass,
and they are related to the fact that QCD is not a doesn't sit at a fixed point. It has a non-trivial renormalization group flow.
Ouch.
Let me ask a very naive question, which I feel like I should know the answer to, but I'll send them down. The Hamiltonian constraint in shape dynamics is a function also of Higgs constant. The conformal constraint, the pi equals constant g, is not a function of Higgs constant. Treated different morphisms of constraint, even with matter, is not a function of Higgs constant. So the Hamiltonian constraint, if matter allowed, is a function of Higgs constant. So there is a dimensional quantity.
But that one can be pulled out of the reaction. So it's related to dynamical similarity, I think. At least that's how I've always understood it, that you can always pull the units out of the action, and then that doesn't change the stationary point.
You can pull the Higgs constant out of the action for pure gravity, and then that would try to be
plus mass.
That's why I always say cosmological constant plus any mass parameter that you need to have in the UV. Because Newton's constant can be pulled out that way.
But there's a way to say something about quantum mechanics. In the free particle, the equations of motion at a Lagrangian level for the free particle say that the acceleration is zero. And you can write that theory in the trajectories of the Lagrangian level without mentioning that the particle has a particular value of mass. So it looks scale and right. The canonical theory of a free non-relativistic particle has the mass in it, because P is mass times the velocity. So, and that shows when you quantize the theory, is the quantum theory of that free particle has a Compton wavelength, which is a physical scale, whereas the classical theory doesn't depend on. I know you, you know. Let me just finish my thought.
Yeah, go on.
Let me just finish my thought. So quantization takes a theory which is scale members, the simplest possible theory is the single non-relativistic particle, where the mass is an irrelevant parameter, and it becomes a relevant parameter to its quantum mechanics. Now, in the same way, general relativity without matter at the Lagrangian level, you can scale Newton's constant out and put in the matter, and then you set the matter to zero. But in quantum gravity, which you can see at the full level or the linearized level, the Planck lane, the h bar g, plays a role like the Compton wavelength.
It's interesting that it's formally the same reason why in quantum mechanics you can define von Neumann entropy in absolute terms, but in classical physics, the entropy is not well defined because you really have a unit, a dimensionable unit, which is h bar, that allows you to chop up phase space into discrete pieces. So I don't know.
I don't know if we're going to have any more discussion, but Ed Adam, people do introduce this distinction between a finger means I want to raise a point in coming on this discussion, and a hand means I want to come in on a new point, but I want to come in on Lee's point there.
Sounds like
as long as you have just a single particle and its wave factor is spreading, that has no meaning. You would have to have two particles with two different masses, and then they would spread in a different way.
Okay.
And I think that's, so we get back to the observable things are always ratios, I believe. I think we should just keep, never forget that.
Then I was going
to... Let me tell a joke.
This is a joke.
Yeah, no, this is quite funny.
It's two hands, I think.
I had this lovely Matteo Lostaglio staying with me, and he asked me, how do you tell the difference between a cup and a mug? So I said, well, it's all to do with the ratios of how wide the mug is to its depth, and the cup is, the ratio is more, is different. And you got hysterics because Tubman is always on about ratios. And then Verena's carer came in and I said, Kim, what's the difference between a cup and a mug? She said, cup's got a saucer.
This last point of that, if you really thought that everything was about ratio, you might make the proposal that Dirac made, that all dimensional constants should scale in ratio to this total scale of the size of the universe, and a dimensionless number, which is supposed to be the number of particles. And that would lead you to conclude that Newton's constant should scale like the power of the Hubble constant. And it just doesn't. It's so disappointing that it doesn't work. And that, in fact, that's ruled out by something like 4 or 5 orders of magnitude now by experiments.
So which experiments are that? Is it like structure formation? Or what specifically is it that doesn't work out?
Maybe nuclear. I actually don't.
The bounds on the is not very strong, is it?
They are very strong, and I'm glad they don't know what.
I think it's several orders of magnitude. You would expect the gravitational constant to vary on with the time scale of the expansion of the universe.
Just as.
When I started working with collaborating with Bertotti 40 years ago, it was still possible that it could be, but no longer. By the way, Dirac seems to have had that idea because he didn't want sort of intelligent life ever to come to an end.
Mm-hmm. Open hand.
I have a hand because I want to change. I don't know when we're ending the discussion, but I wanted to get people's opinion on this because there's an issue which I think we all noticed right from the beginning, which is that there is a very natural candidate for a ubiquitous point, which is power counting or normalizable. So it's maybe even a candidate for a Gaussian fixed point, which is just the fixed point of Jean-Lipschitz, right? I mean, when you have the conformal value of the kinetic term, and then the Cotton tensor as your lowest dimensional operator, that's a violent variant.
Carton squared.
That's a violent variant theory. And then.
Square root of Carton squared.
Whatever. There's some small issues there. But, So basically,
the square root is non-zero. Is there a square root or not?
Yeah, okay, well, I have
a... There's a lapse there, right? So
there's a lapse there, and it depends on how you transform the lapse and move about transformation.
Yeah.
But the point is that, like, especially the statement in the Java literature is that that's a bound-invariant theory, and they get it by turning the argument backward. Well, from our point of view, they say, let's impose anisotropic scaling, and then you get this effective symmetry in the UV, which is bound invariance, and that's the thing that's making it a fixed point in the first place, right? But then...
Is it true that they get this? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah, they do, because... And that's actually why... Because the Cotton tensor has three spatial derivatives, and the Cotton square tensor has six, right? And then if you look, if they say, I want to impose manifest unitarity, then my kinetic term can only have two time derivatives. And then you have two time derivatives, six spatial derivatives, and so there's an anisotropic scaling of 3:1. Yeah. So we actually, if we just want to impose violent variance throughout the whole RG flow, we pick up that argument for free. And moreover, in their scenario, you have to break the violent variance because they want to get an IR limit, which is general relativity. And once they break that symmetry, the scalar field pops up, you get an extra degree of freedom, and that's the thing that's unstable and unbounded and maybe not, so it has all the problems. Whereas in our scenario, you keep the violent variance to the whole RG because our IR fixed point is also violent variant, with the exception of maybe the volume, right? And then it's like a nice scenario where you don't have this unstable field popping up. You have an RG flow, but now the challenge is like, how do you connect these two fixed points, right? Because the UV one is nice, and it seems to have all kinds of nice properties. And it's the thing that made Hijab Lipschitz as popular as it is, right? The IR fixed point is the problem because it has inverse Laplacian, right? So how do I define a functional RG flow between two fixed points where one of them has inverse Laplacian? And that, I think, is like maybe another way of like reiterating all the problems that we was asking about before. What's the machinery for defining a functional RG flow equation that can accommodate this scenario? And the last point I want to make is about anomalies, because when Javis, I mean, I asked him why the obvious thing would have been for him to keep that as a gauge symmetry, the violent variance. And he said, I didn't like it because of the conformal, the Biot anomaly. But I realized that now that it's because he was thinking in the space-time picture, right? So he's always thinking that if you have violent variance in CMC gauge, there's a hidden notion of four-dimensional violent variance. But our scenario is very different because we don't have space-time. So we really have space and time different. And so there is no violent anomaly if you have closed spatial topology, which is what we like. If the spatial topology is closed, there just is no violent anomaly.
So let's be first why
the I'm sharing and so I'm taking myself as
I hope there's lots of comments. Okay.
I just wanted to make but do you I just wanted to comment on the first thing.
Okay.
Did you want to comment on the second one? Okay.
Finger?
So one of the things is about Hijab-Lipschitz gravity and perturbative renormalizability. I mean, perturbative renormalizability is not enough to give you a fundamental theory, right? I mean, QED is the prime example. It's perturbative renormalizable, but you have a Landau pole. So if you're looking at the, you know, the Gaussian fixed point in Hijab-Lipschitz gravity, you have to make sure that all your couplings that you want to be non-zero in the infrared are actually UV attractive.
Mm-hmm.
For that fixed point. So, you know, just having a Gaussian fixed point is not enough. I mean,
yes.
In standard gravity, you also have a Gaussian fixed point at vanishing Newton coupling, but, it, you know, it's repulsive in the Newton coupling, and so therefore you can't use it for the fundamental theory. So you know,
mm-hmm.
when you want to use that fixed point, you have to make sure
yeah.
that it's actually compatible with the low energy bias of the couplings. And then the second thing, if I understood you correctly, you wanted to understand how you get an infrared fixed point, which has stuff like 1 over the Laplacian.
Yeah.
So, I mean... What the renormalization group flow does for you is it automatically generates non-localities as you go towards the infrared.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, structures like 1 over the Laplacian, you can understand that as being a sort of resummation of infinitely many local terms of arbitrary higher order. So, for instance, you know, the Polyakov action in 2D has exactly the structure of R1 over box R. And you can actually get that from just following every normalization group flow, which is completely local in the sense that it just has positive powers of derivatives, and which you then in the infinite limit resum. So that's, you know,
the
getting reproducing these.
Looks very much like the minimization of Liouville action.
I think the problem with kind of non-local Hamiltonians is if you take them seriously at the microscopic level, because then in your theory space you have to introduce all sorts of, you know, higher order non-local things, and then you're, you know, that's not good.
It's an effect.
But, so it's, you know, as the infrared limit, I think it's perfectly fine to, you know, you
the
renormalization group flow can.
That's encouraging.
Well, you have, I mean. So you have to just, you know, look at really the theory space with arbitrary high powers of derivatives, and then, you know, through resummations you can produce non-local structures like that.
That sounds like still a complicated thing,
right? In 2D there is a paper by, I think, Alessandro Cordello, who's done that explicitly for the Polyakov action and showed how it really emerges in the K going to zero limit. So.
That is a preference. Yeah.
If I don't do it, can you remind me to do it?
Interesting.
Yeah, so then you had another finger.
I forgot.
forgot.
But I said the word anomalies and everyone started to.
Comment was that it's not, I mean, yes, sure, if you had three-dimensional conformal symmetry and a three-dimensional, just a geometry, you would have no conformal anomaly, but this is not the setting. It's a Hamiltonian theory. You also have momenta, you have other fields.
Uh-huh.
And how do you have these anisotropic, you have an anisotropic kind of symmetry. And so the anomaly scenario in Hamiltonian theories of this sort is different. You have to, and there is room for an anomaly even in our case.
This is news, actually.
Yeah.
Well,
if you had read.